quietly, taking their time as they closed the distance with the wounded antelope. At 50 yards, Muzi halted and took a knee. Louis and Reese raised their binoculars and took in the gruesome sight. The ordinarily massive eland bull was skin and bones, the sun filtering through the forest and shining on the corners of his hips, ribs, and spine. There was something embedded in his haunches. If the bull was aware of their presence, he didn't show it. Louis leaned back to whisper in Reese's ear.
"He needs to be put down. Are you comfortable with that?"
"Don't take him before it's his time, Reese." His father's words echoed the wisdom of generations past.
"It's past his time," Reese thought, sidestepping to the right and bracing his left hand against the trunk of a small tree.
He moved the flag-type safety with his thumb and exhaled slowly. His finger touched the trigger as the front sight found the bull's shoulder, and he began to increase pressure. Reese's shoulder absorbed the recoil as the sights rocked skyward. Without taking the butt from his shoulder, he cycled the action and reacquired his sight picture.
"Nice shot. He's down,"
Louis said as he patted Reese on the shoulder. Muzi began walking directly toward the fallen animal, and the other two men followed. Reese never took pleasure in the killing of an animal. Though putting finger to trigger or knocking an arrow and bringing a bow to full draw was the culmination of one's training and preparation, it wasn't something Reese celebrated. Instead, after sending his bullet or releasing his arrow, he'd approach the animal quietly, kneel, and place his hand on the creature he'd taken to provide for his family. He respected the wild others, much more so than the men he'd put in the ground. Flies were everywhere. A wire snare had entangled the eland's leg, just above the hoof, and the wound had festered for weeks. The hoof itself had been severed, leaving nothing for the animal to walk on but a horribly infected stump covered in maggots. A homemade axe was embedded in its back between the hips, and a massive gash on the bull's face was probably made with the same weapon. A big eland bull in prime condition can weigh close to a ton. This one wouldn't weigh half that. The law of club and fang, Reese thought, remembering a classic novel from his youth. Whatever poacher had trapped the eland indiscriminately with the wire snare had attempted, unsuccessfully, to kill it with the axe. The bull's flesh would have brought a significant sum in the local bush meat trade. The skin and horns had value as well. Nature is a cruel place, but this animal's suffering was purely man-made. Reese was enraged at the poacher's callous disregard for the suffering of their quarry. He was just beginning to learn about life in the African bush, but he knew more than a little about hunting men, and he was about to apply those ample skills to a new cause. As Reese stared at the gruesome scene, Louis retrieved a small pack and a jerry can from the cruiser. He took a notebook from the bag and made some notes, glancing at his watch as well as a small GPS unit. When he was finished, he took detailed photos with a digital camera to document the atrocity. His documentation of the scene complete, he nodded to Muzi, who cleared the brush around the carcass with his panga. Louis doused the eland with diesel fuel and flicked his cigarette toward the bluish fluid, the smell of burning hair and flesh bringing Reese back to dark places in his past. After dinner that night, Rich Hastings invited Reese back to the fire pit for a drink.
"Nasty business today, eh?"
The total disregard for suffering reminded me of Iraq at the height of the war.
"They're the same kind of people. They don't care about anything or anyone but themselves. For some of these blokes, it's just a way to make a living, but that doesn't excuse the suffering. We provide jobs and meat to the surrounding villages, so most of the poaching is to feed the Chinese camps that are exploiting the natural resources of this country, with only the politicians that made the deals getting rich on the take.
Now I'm starting to talk like a greenie."
Rich shook his head, staring into the burning embers.
"The real bad actors are the men at the top. They profit while those doing the killing take all the risk. Sound familiar, James?"
The general public in Europe and the States don't see the difference between what we do and what the poachers do. Without us here, the game would be gone. We're out there protecting it because it has value to our business, sure, but we also love this place and these animals. We manage and conserve it for the next generation. The poachers, on the other hand, would wipe the game out in a year or two if we let them have their go. Look at what happened in Kenya in 77. They banned hunting because the poaching was out of control. With the hunters out of the field, it was open season for the poaching syndicates. They killed 500,000 elephants in no time at all. We'll lose out in the end, and that will be that. The game will be left to the poachers. How can I help, Rich? I think I could be an asset if we put some thought into it. Before I die, he almost added, before thinking better of it. The boys and I have done our best to keep the poachers in check, but we all have other jobs to do. I don't know what your long-term plans are, but you should consider studying to be a PH. It takes a few years, but with your background, I'm sure you'll pick it up quickly. To be honest, I haven't been thinking long-term, Rhys replied, remembering his brain tumor. Well, let me do that for you. Tomorrow you'll start working for us as an appy. You can run our anti-poaching efforts. I'll give you 2 good trackers. They'll at least keep you from getting lost. Learn everything you can from them. They're uneducated in the formal sense, but they are professors of the bush. I'll do what I can, Rich. I know you will, son. I know you will. Rhys set his alarm to wake him before dawn. He had a job to do. Despite a long career in the military, Rhys wasn't an early riser by nature. Whenever he did wake up early, he felt like he was in on a secret, one that those still in bed would never know. Though it was before 6 o'clock a.m., he could already hear the hum of the diesel generators powering the camp so the cooks could perform their morning rituals, just like overseas. It was time to gear up for work. He turned on the small lamp on the bedside table and once again laid out the gear that he'd taken from the boat, this time with more focus. He had his Glock 19, its holster, and 3 spare magazines. There was a Surefire flashlight, a Petzl headlamp, a folding knife, and a Gerber multi-tool. He had his watch, his small Garmin, boots, and new clothing thanks to Richard Hastings. He picked up his Winkler Sioc Tomahawk and examined the curved edge, remembering when he'd used it last to remove the head of the man who had arranged the ambush of his SEAL troop in Iraq. All told, it was less than he was used to working with, but it was enough. He thought of World War II UDTs like his grandfather, who got it done with little more than a mask, swim fins, a knife, and maybe an M3 grease gun. Rhys dressed for the field in his boots, shorts, and an olive button-down shirt. He picked up his Glock from the bed and released the magazine to ensure that it was loaded with 15 rounds. Reinserting the mag, he pulled back the slide far enough to confirm that a 9mm round was in the chamber before stuffing it under his pillow. None of the other PHs wore sidearms, and if he wanted to blend in, he was going to have to leave his pistol behind. The remainder of the gear went into his backpack, which he slung over his shoulder as he headed off in search of coffee, his rifle in one hand like a suitcase, binoculars in a harness around his neck. The dining area was empty in the pre-dawn darkness, but he found fresh coffee and poured himself a cup. The cook had already taken note that Rhys liked to add honey to his coffee and had placed a jar beside the cream on the buffet table. Say what you want about the journeys to get to this place. At least the service was good. As if on cue, the cook appeared carrying a plate of toast.
Good morning, Patrao.
The cook smiled broadly, genuinely happy to see him. Good morning.
Eggs for you?
Sure, eggs would be great, thank you.
Right away, Patrao.
The cook bowed his head slightly and headed back toward the kitchen. Rhys was somewhat embarrassed by being waited on hand and foot, but he figured he could get used to it. He took a seat at the table and enjoyed the solitude as he drank his coffee. He was halfway done with his eggs and toast
by the time the rest of the camp made their way, one by one, to the table. They all ate in relative silence. The work was hard and the hours long, with few breaks during the season. Rich Hastings finished his breakfast and addressed Reese.
"James, today you'll go out with your trekkers. They are good men, Solomon and Gona. They came with me from Zimbabwe, but they know this place as well as anyone and won't steer you wrong."
"Thanks, Rich."
Reese rose from the table and followed Hastings toward the white Toyota Land Cruiser. The sun was starting to rise and the camp was bathed in the pinkish-gray light of the African dawn. The two men loading the truck stopped when they saw Hastings and Reese approach and stood next to each other alongside the truck with their hands at their sides, in a relaxed version of the military position of attention. The taller of the two men was also the youngest. He appeared to be in his 20s, thin and muscular. He wore olive-green coveralls and a British desert camouflage boonie hat with the sides turned up. He was good-looking and carried himself with an air of confidence that set him apart from the other trackers Reese had met.
"Reese, this is Solomon."
The young man smiled warmly and extended his hand to Reese, who shook it firmly.
"Nice to meet you, Solomon."
"Very nice to meet you, Mr. Reese,"
he said in perfect, though accented English.
"You can just call me Reese."
Reese wasn't worried about using his real name among the workers. If anyone was looking for him, he'd be dead and buried from the tumor long before anyone questioned a game tracker in East Africa about a man last seen on an affluent island off the east coast of the United States.
"Yes, sir."
The second man was smaller and older, probably closer to Reese's age. His skin was very dark, which contrasted sharply with his tan coveralls and ball cap. A skinning knife hung from the fabric belt around his waist.
"This is Gona."
"Very nice to meet you as well, Gona."
Gona's face remained stoic as Reese shook the man's hand.
"Gona, Mr. Reese is a good friend of Utilivu."
Suddenly, the tracker's eyes brightened.
"Mr. James, you remember me? You remember Gona?"
"Gona, of course. Great to see you again," Reese said in the middle of an enthusiastic handshake, remembering the tracker from his trip to Zimbabwe with Rafe all those years ago.
"How is Utilivu?"
"Rafe is great, Gona. He's really doing well. I know he misses tracking with you." Hastings bid them good luck as they loaded up. Solomon drove, Reese sat in the passenger seat, and Gona rode on the high seat in the bed. They mostly worked the perimeter roads that bordered the concession, looking for signs that poachers had crossed onto the property.
"There has to be a more effective and efficient way to do this," Reese thought.
It was past noon when Reese's stomach began to protest. He'd become accustomed to his hosts dictating the schedule, and it struck him that his men were waiting for him to tell them it was time to eat.
"Let's stop somewhere for lunch, Solomon." "Yes, there is a good place just ahead."
Solomon's mood brightened at the mention of food. When the truck stopped, Reese climbed into the bed and helped the men unload the chairs, cooler, and other assorted gear that made up the lunchtime spread. He made sure that he was the one setting up the folding camp chairs, setting three of them in a triangle under the shade of the tree that they'd parked under. This drew strange looks from Solomon and Gona as they wondered who else might be joining them. When the food containers were opened on the table, Reese motioned for the men to make their plates.
"No, no, you eat, Mr. Reese."
"We're changing things up. You guys eat first."
The two trackers exchanged puzzled looks.
"Go on, make your plates, guys."
Reese motioned toward the food. The men shrugged and moved toward the table. Solomon went first, making a plate for himself and then walking toward the base of the tree to sit.
"No, no, sit in the chair. You guys are eating with me. If we're going to be a team, we'll eat together, at least out here."
Solomon hesitated for a minute and then broke into a smile and took his place in one of the chairs. Reese was building a team, and in the close-knit world of special operations, where officers and enlisted men trained, fought, slept, and bled in the same mud, leaders ate last.
Rhys thought of his SEAL teams, the skills developed and honed through the hunting of men as they dismantled and destroyed terrorist networks across the globe. Rhys was adapting those skills to a different battlefield against a new adversary. It was time to hunt again.
Chapter 25. MacDill Air Force Base, Tampa, Florida. March. Getting up from his office chair was painful for Sergeant Major Jeff Oteke, thanks to the 7.62mm bullet that had shattered his femur in Sadr City a decade earlier. That bullet had turned the 3rd Special Forces Group's most promising sniper into a desk-bound staff NCO. He could have retired medically thanks to the plates and screws that held his leg together, but he felt a duty to train and mentor the soldiers who came after him, passing along his knowledge to the next generation of Special Forces operators. That path led him to an instructor slot at the Special Forces Sniper Course at Fort Bragg's Range 37, a job for which he was perfectly suited. His current position was not so stimulating, as the senior non-commissioned officer of the SOF Warrior Acquisition Office at SOCOM, which was part of the Special Operations Force Acquisition and Logistics Office, the once-proud warrior now spent his days going over gear requests instead of teaching snipers to stalk and kill their prey. He'd resigned himself to his fate and dedicated his efforts to putting the best equipment available in the hands of the Special Operations soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines still working downrange. He worked long hours to shuttle requests through the acquisition process as quickly as possible and had learned to navigate this new battlefield nearly as effectively as he'd done in the streets of Iraq. He was still able to contribute at the tactical level by spending much of his free time training SWAT snipers from all over Florida's Gulf Coast. It was his overseas battlefield experience that made the current request on his desk seem unusual. Someone was requesting a pair of Shytac M200 sniper rifles with high-end night force optics and a large amount of match ammunition for a joint U.S.-NATO sniper program in Turkey. Relations with Turkey had become increasingly strained as of late, and it struck Oteke as strange that the United States would be urgently shipping them high-end sniper weapons systems. This wasn't a rifle that fit into the traditional military arsenal of either the Americans or Turks. As a sniper, he was very familiar with its extreme long-range capability, and this wasn't something he wanted in the hands of the bad guys on his watch. Trusting his instincts had kept his men alive on the battlefield, and those same instincts were now sounding the administrative alarm. The sergeant major made a few calls to his contacts in the special operations community, and thanks to a friend in the military deputy's office, he was able to trace the request to a call placed from a Senate staffer a week earlier. It wasn't totally out of the ordinary for someone on the Hill to carry water for a weapons manufacturer constituent, but it was rarely for something so specific. Having done his due diligence, it was time to go see the boss. As he pushed himself up from his chair, he took a moment to steady himself before making his way into the glass-paneled hallway that led to the program executive officer's domain. Oteke had encountered a few good officers during his military career, but his current boss was not one of them. Major Charlie Serco was a logistician, and not a particularly good one. He had been a mediocre field artillery officer before transitioning to the Acquisition Corps, where he did nothing but hone his skill for managing his career up the chain of command. The NCOs on his staff were all convinced that his regulation-length brown mustache was the result of the time he spent crawling up the SOCOM acquisition director's ass. This, along with his rodent-like face, led to his nickname, Gerbil. Oteke's limp became less noticeable as his leg muscles loosened with each step. Exhaling deeply, he knocked on the gerbil's open doorframe.
"Sir, do you have a moment?"
Major Serco looked up, surprised to see the